welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. As ever, I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and thanks for joining me again this week. On this week's episode, we're not looking at a particular film. This time out, we're going to be discussing a new book that's just been released by Candlewick Press. The book is called Smile, How Young Charlie Chaplin Taught the World to Laugh and Cry. It's written by Gary Golio and illustrated by Eddie Young, and I'm absolutely delighted to say that Gary Golio joins me on the podcast today. Hi, Gary.
Good morning, Carl. How are you?
Yeah, really well, thanks. Really pleased that you've come on to talk to me today.
Thank you.
Yeah, really nice to talk to are you a native New Yorker, Gary, or is that just where you've made your kind of home?
No, born and bred. I grew up in a little town on the Hudson River called Dobbs Ferry, very quaint name, because there was a ferry there many, many years ago. And we moved to another historical town called Scarborough last year after 35 years in another historical town. So I've been a New Yorker all my life.
I just imagine, I mean, like I sort of said to you before we started recording, all I know about New York is what I've seen in the movies, basically. But I imagine it's a place, you know, a lot of cultural kind of things going on, a lot of opportunities and so on. I mean, is that right? Or have I been fed a misleading impression from the movies?
Well, I think we here in New York, we like to believe it's the capital of the world. And it is, you know, historically, it's a very exciting place. I mean, if it only had the Metropolitan Museum of Art, I was a painter for many years, a landscape painter. If it only had the Met, it would be a great town.
Yeah, fascinating that you should mention that you're a painter, because I was going to ask you about this later. So yeah, before we come to this book that's just been released, which we're going to talk about, I thought it'd be good to just to get to know you a little bit better. So what's kind of your background, Gary? What made you want to become a writer? I mean, from what I've seen on your website, it sounds like perhaps your father was a bit of a formative artistic influence on you. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I would say that I place all of the arts under the heading of artists. So
yeah.
You asked me, you know, what led me to become a writer. Actually, my dad was, in the best of ways, he was an amateur artist when I was very young. He was the kind of person who could draw anything out of his head. I remember watching him draw a Native American, you know, we used to call Indians at that time, you know, on horseback, and he would just sit there with a pad on his lap and draw out of his imagination, which just fascinated me. And both of my parents were very, very eclectic or open in their interest in music, and my grandmother as well, whom I grew up with. So I would watch these movies with a lot of black entertainers. There'd be all sorts of jazz, pop, big band. I felt like I was a child of the Depression, though I'm not that old, because they all lived through the Depression. And but my father communicated to me a sense of the art spirit and investing yourself in something, becoming good at it, caring about what you do, and of course, you know, the love of things visual. He was very much an appreciator of beauty in a visual sense. And as a boy, I liked to write little stories for my class in fifth grade. But I was a visual artist for many years, a landscape painter, and then I became a therapist, a psychotherapist, working with teens and adults around addiction problems. And then I was reading a book in like 2002, I guess, and it was about, because I love to play electric blues guitar, and it was the tome, the kind of definitive biography at the time on Jimi Hendrix. And I thought, my wife was a writer of children's books at that time, and I had not published anything, but I was reading the story of Jimmy's childhood, and I thought, that's the story that humanizes him, that goes beyond all of the myths. And so that's when I wrote my first story, and it was later published in 2010. But all of these books, whether they're about musicians like Bob Dylan, I've written about John Coltrane, Charlie Parker, Billie Holiday, they're all about the roots of an artist's talent and creativity in their childhood. And they're intended to kind of show kids like roadmaps.
Yeah, so I obviously want to follow up on these books about musicians, which sound fascinating, but just to kind of backtrack slightly, because you talk about the kind of creative paths that open up, and one thing that I thought was fascinating on your website, on the biography there, that it'll probably interest listeners to this podcast, is you say that seeing the film Lust for Life with Kirk Douglas was a big moment for you, and yeah, could you just tell us a bit about that, perhaps?
Yes, yes. I was in fifth grade, and I had a teacher. I had some very nice teachers in elementary school, but this teacher took a particular interest in me and really encouraged me, and that means so much to a young person. And she was the person who encouraged me to write and present my little stories in what we used to call in the United States show and tell. You'd have a little spot in the morning in your class, and a kid would get up and talk about something. And so I had my father, you know, as a lover of things visual and particularly the visual arts, he and I were watching what used to be called Saturday Night at the Movies. One Saturday night, my mom was out, and it was this amazing story about Vincent van Gogh. I don't know if I'd even heard Vincent's name before, but Kirk Douglas really did deserve an Oscar for that movie. Of course, you know, Anthony Quinn won Best Supporting, but he really did deserve it. I mean, it was just a bravura performance, and I saw, you know, they had, in fact, a person who later became a very renowned children's illustrator, Robert Andrew Parker, every day he had to paint a canvas that looked like one of, you know, was supposed to be one of Vincent's canvases and paintings. And they would show it on the screen in the movie.
Yep.
And these images kind of burned themselves into my memory. And I was so moved by his, and it was a very sad tale of Vincent's life. And so Monday morning I went in to the library in my middle school, and the librarian said, you know, what'd you do over the weekend? And I told her about this film, and she said, would you like to see a book on Vincent van Gogh? And I said, sure. I wasn't much of a reader.
Yeah.
And she showed me this art book for children, and it just blew my mind that every painting reproduced in the book I had seen in the movie. It was kind of surreal for me, and it made a long-lasting impression, not just about visual art but and painting, but I'm a real cinephile, and I believe in the power of, you know, if I wasn't an author, I would be a filmmaker, because I really believe in the power of film and cinema, and of course, Chaplin is my testament to that.
So... so these books about musicians that you've written, that you've mentioned already. So I'm a huge fan personally of Bob Dylan. So I was really pleased to see, you know, you'd written a book about him, How Bob Met Woody, referring, of course, to Woody Guthrie. And I think that story about Dylan going to see Guthrie is a fascinating one. But I was just wondering what the balance has to be with these books that you do between someone like being a significant artist and them also having like a life story or a backstory that has storytelling potential. Does that ever pose you any kind of challenges?
No, I mean, you know, I have many people when they're introduced to me, or I meet them at a party or their home or something, and they say, oh, Gary, I've got a great idea. I know you write these books about musicians, AC/DC. And I'm like, oh, I don't know about that. You know, and what people don't often understand who don't write children's books is that you have to find, as you're saying, as you're alluding to, you have to find a story that makes sense for kids. Now, you can write for little kids, you can write for middle grade kids, you can write for young adult, for teens, that's all fine. But you have to find a story that they can understand. It's like you don't give a child, you know, a license to drive when he's 5 years old, and you don't tell certain stories. Bob Dylan is a very complex guy. Woody Guthrie was a very complex person. And I wanted to find a story that I thought, and I still believe, kids can, you know, they can resonate to this idea of having a hero, having a mentor, someone you look up to. And when we're young, and certainly as adults, we need important role models that we can believe in, that give us courage and hope as we move along in our own lives and try to accomplish things. And so that was, you know, a story about a young man, Bob Dylan, coming from this mining town in northern Minnesota, where it's bleakly cold in the winter near the border of Canada, and, you know, learning about this man, this guy, Woody Guthrie, who not only traveled all over the country on trains, you know, like hopping onto trains and going to hobo jungles and all this stuff, but a man whose example, being able to sit down and turn a story into a song, really had a great impact on Bob. So, yeah, I always look for something that I think, you know, and that's why I often don't write full biographies of these people for kids, because I think it's better to find a story that encapsulates the importance and personality of one of these subjects rather than telling a birth, yeah, you know, cradle to grave story.
Yeah, and I think that's something that the Chaplin book does really well, actually. I'm going to ask you about that specifically later. But so these books about musicians, like you say, you've written a few of them, and the people you've mentioned, so John Coltrane, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, Billie Holiday and Carlos Santana. So are there any other kind of key musical figures you're either planning to write about or just somebody you'd love to write about one day but just haven't got around to yet?
Well, interestingly, Carl, yes, I've got two books contract. One of them is edited already. If you asked Jimmy Page and Jack White who they thought their favorite or the best slide guitarist in music history was, they would say Blind Willie Johnson. And this was a black man who was a preacher in the United States. He died in 1947, I believe, the same year Carlos Santana was born, interestingly. But he had a brief period when his records were very popular from like 1929 to 1931 or so, and he outsold Bessie Smith, which was a big deal. He was a very spiritual guy. He saw his music not as blues, which most people thought it sounded like, but as gospel. And when the Depression hit, he didn't record anymore. He became sort of a lay preacher. He died in sort of sad circumstances that had to do with a fire in his house and pneumonia. And he was just forgotten until the in the United States and also in, you know, in Britain at that time, in the folk revival in the 60s, Reverend Gary Davis said, "You think I'm good? You got to hear this guy, Blind Willie Johnson." And he started handing out copies of Willie's album to people and young people. And long story, we'll go fast forward a bit. In the 1970s, mid-1970s, 77, I believe, Carl Sagan at NASA was going to send up Voyager 1. And I don't know if you know about the Golden Record, which was on the yeah, satellite. And it was kind of like an original CD-ROM, and it had a player on board in case other cultures or civilizations discovered satellite. And so Carl Sagan called up music ethnologist John, the father and son team, John, I'll remember his name, and he was a legendary musicologist, and Carl Sagan called him up and said, you know, what do you think about these selections I've made, this Bach and Beethoven and Mozart? And John said to him, you know, this is all nice, but you need some really unusual stuff that represents the earth in a very different way and its people, like Aboriginal songs and women's songs and all these unusual things like the sound of raindrops. And he said, and there's one song you have to put on this record, because it's the embodiment of human loneliness. And it was a song by Blind Willie Johnson called Dark Was the Night. And so here's the story about this man who died in poverty, very spiritual guy who was always thinking about heaven, and his song ends up on this machine, this satellite that we shoot out into space.
Yeah.
And, you know, it has this amazing song in which he hums and plays slide guitar. It's very otherworldly and very beautiful. It's a little eerie in terms of how it gets into your heart, but that's one book. And the other one, I had the good fortune to call up and was able to speak on the phone with jazz legend Sonny Rollins. Here this year. And long story how that came about, I had to send him my books, and he's not doing any in-person interviews anymore, but he does them on the phone. And he's 88 years old now, but he's sharp as a tack, an amazing man. And he said, you know, send me your jazz books, and I'll decide if, you know, we're going to talk. And so we talked. I did write my book. I sold it to a wonderful editor named Nancy Paulson with Penguin Books in New York City. And it's coming out next year and will be illustrated by a very wonderful artist named James Ransom. So these books have taken me to unusual places that I never thought I would ever go, you know.
Yeah, that's incredible. I think if anybody's kind of fact-checking us at home, I think John and Alan Lomax are the musicologists, aren't they?
Thank you for filling in my little moment gap there.
That's all right. So I guess Smile, the book, seems to represent a bit of a departure for you then, just in the sense that Chaplin, of course, such a big motion picture star. So what does Chaplin represent to you, and like, why do you think he continues to remain such a significant figure?
Well, you know, I look at him again under that big umbrella of artist. I mean, you know that he was not just the actor in these movies. Early on, and I think it was his 13th movie with Keystone, he began directing. And he was a director, he was a writer, he was a producer, he was an actor. He created the music. Of course, the book is based on that song, Smile, you know, which is in Modern Times, of course, with Paulette Goddard. And, you know, he played three instruments himself. He played piano, violin, and cello. He was a very musical guy. And he was a great acrobat. I mean, W.C. Fields once said, I'm not going to use any profanity, but he said of Chaplin, he's the blankety-blank best ballet dancer that he'd ever seen. And, you know, if you watch a movie like The Cure, and they part the curtains at one point when they're in this kind of spa, out he comes and does this amazing dance. And so it was the fact that not only was he beloved by me when I was a kid, and by my parents, and my grandparents, and my daughter in later years, but he was everything. He was the consummate artist. He was very, very intelligent man, had a real sense of the art spirit and artistry, and combined it all in one human being, which is, you know, it's like Picasso. I consider like Dylan, Picasso, and Chaplin. There's something about those three people where they're able to synthesize all these amazing influences that are taking place around them or in the past and bring them forward and make something new. And of course, that's almost the definition of an artist itself, you know.
Yeah, so as you've sort of said, I mean, consciously you decide not to tell kind of the whole kind of birth to death story. So what's kind of interesting about this book is obviously Chaplin, someone who grew up in London during the late Victorian era. So again, a place and a time that's quite familiar to us from movies and novels and so on, often seems like a very vibrant setting, but, you know, a place that could be very rough if you were kind of in poverty. So
very rough, yes.
Yeah, was that kind of the appeal to you about sort of writing about Chaplin's childhood? That it lent itself to retelling, I suppose?
Yes, you know, it was because I wanted, everyone knows, well, I kind of like to think, although I've been surprised when I've talked to some 20-somethings and editors, 20-something-year-old editors in children's books, and I mention this, and they say, "Who's Charlie Chaplin?" And I think, and I smack my head, and I'm like, "Oh, well, but that's why we're doing the book, you know." But the point is to introduce Chaplin to a new generation of readers. And as for, you know, the story I'm telling, it's really the true, and this is all nonfiction. These books are all based on facts. There's, you know, plenty of back matter at the back of the book that documents everything. And it's about the origins of this amazing tramp character, the little tramp, the little fellow that he created, which, as a character, when no one in the world really knew what the man, Charlie Chaplin, looked like in 1914, 1915, he became, quote, the most famous person in the world, the little tramp. And, you know, I grew up not in circumstances that were anywhere near as impoverished as Charlie's. I mean, there were times when his mother was in an asylum and his brother is away in the Navy and he's eating out garbage cans. I mean, this is very serious, you know, and it has a, as I said, I was a therapist for many years and worked with kids who were underprivileged as well. And this has a tremendous and traumatic effect on a child's psyche. And to do this amazing thing, which was to take the sadness and tenderness of those years and all he saw in the theater with, you know, what they used to call clown tramps or tramp clowns, you know, and W.C. Fields was one in this country early on, too. And to take all that rough stuff and that sadness and to embody it in a dramatic character for the screen and then to inject humor into it, that it wasn't just, you didn't come out of those movies in a sense with a sense of despair. You came out with a sense of renewed hope that you could face life's challenges and you could laugh at them, and that would be a saving grace. And, you know, my parents, when they grew up in very poor circumstances, both of them, they were first generation Americans. Their parents had come from Italy in the very early 1900s and were treated very badly, the way Mexicans are treated here now. Italians were considered, you know, they were portrayed as terrorists and thieves and criminals here to steal jobs from the Irish, and it was a terrible thing. And, you know, my parents were about to graduate from high school when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and they both left. And my father went into World War II in the Navy for 6 years. My mother went into a war factory. And, you know, having gone through the Depression, they communicated something to me about the depth of feeling that can come out of being poor and going through something like the Depression. And that really resonated with me always when I watched Charlie's movies, because you're always rooting for this man who really has not a lot going for him, at least materially, but he relies on his wits and he relies on his humor, and it's all in his attitude. Everything is about his attitude, which in the end is a very positive thing. And I think kids pick that up as well as adults.
Yeah, I think so. I absolutely agree, because I regard Chaplin as like a great sentimentalist. And I mean that in the best possible way, because I know sentimentality comes in for a bad rep sometimes. But I know you write in the book about how Chaplin came to realize that funny and sad went hand in hand. And it seems to me like a very pivotal kind of through line in his films, too. And it underpins the book in a very nice way, I think. Was that always the intention, or did that kind of emerge as you worked on it?
Well, I had submitted the book to an editor who was my editor for the Bird and Diz book with the same illustrator, my friend Ed Young, who's won the Caldecott several times. He's an amazing man, an amazing artist. He's 87 years old. And he's an immigrant from China many, many years ago in 1959. But he was my Tai Chi teacher for many years too.
Yeah.
And he's just a remarkable person, always working on two or three books. He, you know, he's unstoppable. And when I submitted this to Sarah Ketcher-Sid, and of course Candlewick has a presence in London, as you probably know, and you know, she looked at it, and the only thing she said was, "Could we turn up the volume a little bit on the funny and sad?" So it was because of her that I chose the title "Smile," and then I said, you know, how young Charlie Chaplin taught the world to laugh, and then in parenthesis, and yep. cry, because his place, and this is certainly, as you know, David Robinson, all of these, Jeffrey Vance, all of the great Chaplin biographers have said, these film historians, that Chaplin, not just because he was a brilliant humorist and actor and filmmaker, but what he did, especially beginning with the movie The Kid with Jackie Coogan in 21, sure, it was easy to be funny, but if you could make people laugh, if you could inject some drama at crucial points, I mean, the ending of The Kid, when Charlie is racing and climbing over rooftops to finally come down onto the street and into that truck and save his child, who, you know, is his adopted child, from going into foster care, wherever they were taking this poor child, you know, it's still, just even talking about it, brings me to tears. I mean, he was, you know, you could watch The Gold Rusher, you could watch the ending of City Lights,
yes.
where the blind woman, because of Charlie's efforts, finally realizes who this man is. And if that doesn't choke you up, you don't have a heart, you know what I mean? So
it was the
pathos, the tenderness in these storylines, and what you said is so perfect about being I'm a sentimentalist. I'm really a sentimental sap, I suppose. But you know, if you can bring that kind of sentimentality, if you can couple it with real intelligence and artistic skill, as Chaplin did, then you're making great film and you're telling a great story. And I think that's his contribution to one of his greatest contributions to the history of cinema.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up a little bit about, you mentioned Ed Young, who illustrated the book, and I mean, I'm looking at the book with kind of an untrained eye in terms of illustrated books, but it seems to me like it must be so important to have a satisfying kind of blend of text and image. Like, the images can really make the text kind of soar, and vice versa. So I think in this book, for example, when Chaplin moves to America, and like you write that in New York City, he strode down Broadway under soaring skyscrapers and 1,000 lights. I think it's really kind of enhanced because the image alongside it's so lovely too. So I was just wondering how that works in practice, you know, the collaboration. Do you sort of write all the text first and you kind of know that he's going to come back with something good, or does it work slightly differently?
Well, normally in children's book, what happens is if you're an author, you sell a book to an editor in a publishing house. And if it's a picture book, that editor and their art director, they find the illustrator that they think would be best for this book. But, you know, I'm kind of an unorthodox fellow, so the last few books, what I've done with the Santana book, with the Bird and Diz book about Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, with the last two books about Sonny Rollins and Blind Willie Johnson that are still to come, I knew these illustrators, and I thought their work would be right for the text, and I sent them, because I know them, I sent them my text, and they said, oh, Gary, yeah, I'm up for this. Just tell this editor, or my editor, or your editor, that I want to be part of this. So what I did with Chaplin was I showed the book to Ed, because we see each other all the time. We've been friends for many years, and we had already done a book together, and I said, Ed, you know, I know you love Chaplin. What do you think? And he, you know, after I made some revisions, and he helped me to bring it up to a higher level, and by being my reader. And finally he said, yes, I'll do it. So then I brought the book to my past editor, Sarah, and I said, Ed is part of this project, but I'll only sell my story if he's the illustrator. And she said, no problem. We've always wanted, you know, we want to work with him again. It's all good. Don't worry about it. So what you do is then she and I worked to do a final edit on the story, and that's when it was given to Ed, because you don't want him to do a spread on a paragraph, let's say, that later gets changed or abridged or edited, you know, and then it doesn't make sense. So you give the illustrator pretty much the final text edit, and then they do that. But what was unusual was that from the beginning, Ed would call me down to his house. We live about 20 minutes from each other, and he's also on the Hudson River, so I would just drive down, and he'd say, I want you to see what I'm doing. And that's very generous, because most of the time in picture books, they intentionally and understandably keep artist and the author apart, because they don't want one kind of, you know, stepping onto the turf of the other. They don't want you telling the artist what to do and vice versa. But Ed, from the beginning, wanted this to be a collaboration. So he would say, what do you think? And I'd say, well, you know, that's could be more accurate if this and this or whatever. Or he'd say, you know, do you think this is powerful enough? Or is it too garish, you know? And I would say, well, you know, this and that. And, you know, for him to take in that kind of feedback and then, as a result, change his artwork and do, and his work is always beautiful and exquisite anyway. It's very unusual. So it was a real collaboration.
And well, the other moment I was like especially sort of taken with is, so through the book, Chaplin's kind of assembling his image and discovering his talent and all this. So then when we finally see him as the little tramp, you know, towards the end of the book, it's a very like satisfying moment, I think. So was that always the end point? Was that kind of a logical way to tackle it?
You know, he says at one point, and I'm sure you've heard this, in his autobiography, which was instrumental in inspiring me to write the book, and it's a wonderful book that kind of, you know, especially in the beginning, because you get the sense of Victorian and Edwardian England and what it was like for a person who didn't have a lot of resources, and his mother as a single parent trying to make her living as a seamstress, taking care of these two boys. It was a really rough time. And anyway, in his autobiography, Chaplin says, you know, this fellow is many-sided, a tramp, a gentleman, a poet, a dreamer, a lonely fellow, always hopeful of romance and adventure. And at one point, he talks about how, and of course, this is a little embellished, but, you know, Chaplin is romantic. So he talks about how he goes, you know, Senate says, oh, Chaplin, go, you know, put something together in the prop room and come out with an outfit. And, you know, he goes into the prop room and he says he took, you know, I forget exactly all the different details. You know, he took Fatty Arbuckle's pants, and he took this person's, you know, vest, and he took this person's hat, and he created this hybrid character, like I said, like Picasso, taking things that seem like they don't necessarily go together, and then he synthesizes them into this amazing new thing. And so, to me, the idea of Charlie as a boy growing up without a father, with his mother who taught him about the art spirit, about how to tell a story, about how to dramatize feelings, human feelings, and seeing all this stuff on the stage as a boy with the eight Lancashire lads and this clog dancing troupe he was in when he was like eight or nine, and then going on the stage and being in young Sherlock Holmes and acting with Carno, with his brother, and all of these things he brings together at that moment at the end of the book, in my book anyway, with that scene in the prop room where, you know, he's taking like Rummy Binks, the man who had this sad gait, this kind of bow-legged gait, who used to take care of horses at the pub in next to where Charlie lived, and all the things that he saw and felt, his mother, the loss of his father, poverty, and he brings it all together. And so finally, at the end of the book, you get to see for the first time, because we haven't seen anything really up until then, you get to see the image of the little tramp. And that, to me, is the reveal and the climax. And, you know, it's especially for kids, little kids, who may not yet have ever seen a Chaplin film. It's to say, this is the beginning. Now you need to go sit down with mommy and daddy or grandma or whoever it is, and watch one of those 20-minute, doesn't have to be long, doesn't even have to watch the kid. You could just go watch, you know, one of those 20-minute shorts and see if I'm not telling the truth about how brilliant this guy is, you know.
Yeah, I think so. I think this is the point we should make sure people listening know. So if you're a parent listening and you're thinking of checking out this book for your children, so at the back of the book there's this kind of informative section with an afterword, a page of facts about Chaplin, a reading list, and then a few suggestions for Chaplin films that are especially suited to children. And it made me think about my own daughter, to be honest. I've got a three-year-old daughter, and it might be just about the right time, I think. And I think the circus, I think I've got an 11-year-old son too, and when he was about 4 or 5, I think I took him to a screening of The Circus, and he really liked it, you know. But I think maybe with these old slapstick silent comedy films, maybe it's catching children at the right time, you know. Children are so open-minded. I think these are films you can show to very young children, and they'll massively enjoy.
Yes, and it's funny. I'm so glad you mentioned the circus, because I do, in the afterword, I have a number of informational pages here, and one of the movies that I suggest is The Circus, and also The Fireman. You know, that's from 1916. It's pretty early. The Circus is 1928. But, and especially because they're silent. The kids don't even need to read the silent film cards, you know, those white letter on black cards that say, you know, that might have a little sentence of dialogue or a little stage direction. They don't need to know any of that, because it's all nonverbal. It's just a visual thing, and the humor as well as the tenderness come through, because Charlie is such a brilliant actor in terms of his ability to use gesture, affect, his facial expressions, his eye movements, and the way he also directs his films to convey tremendous emotion. I mean, he was very, you know, it took him a long time to make a talkie, and what was it, City Lights and Modern Times. You know, that was way past 1927 when talkies came out, and yet he held to that ethos of the silent film. And there's something very beautiful about that whole notion, because there's so much talk and information today. It's you know, there's just too much talk, and to watch a Chaplin silent film is really a relief, I think, in our age of overexposure to media and information.
And do you think, you know, in like 100 years' time, we'll still have people writing books about Chaplin, we'll still have people screening his films? Do you think his appeal will be kind of forevermore?
You know, it's funny, this morning I was looking at the, and I think if somebody does it well, Wikipedia can be good, and they've come to insist more on, you know, making sure people have, footnotes, and that they document everything they're saying. And I see here at the bottom, somebody said something about how it was about his popularity and the characterizations of Chaplin and all that. And it said, in the 21st century, several of Chaplin's films are still regarded as classics and among the greatest ever made. And it mentions how very recently even, and certainly in the last 20 years easily, that all the directors and film institutes and all of these people, professionals and the populace, rank some of his greatest films in the top 10 or top 20 or top 50 of movies of all times. And it says here, books about Chaplin continue to be published regularly, and he is a popular subject for media scholars and film archivists. And I think, as I just said, because of the deluge of information we receive today through media and social media and computer and internet and everything else, I think there's a very important place for what he did, and there will always be people who realize that this is an oasis in a world that's kind of gone mad, if you don't mind me saying so.
All right, Gary, so the book is, as we've already said, but it's Smile, How Young Charlie Chaplin Taught the World to Laugh and Cry. It's on release now, presumably available wherever all good books are sold. But how about you, Gary? I mean, where can people find you or your work online? I mean, I know you've got a very nice website, very visually appealing website, I must say. So perhaps you could point people to that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Carl. Yeah, it's Gary, G-A-R-Y, Golio, G-O-L-I-O. So it's GaryGolio.com. You know, the front page comes up done by a wonderful designer who was a friend of mine. She's an excellent designer now. She was a childhood friend of my daughter. She did this thing with instruments hanging down and school. It's really great. And,
it's really good.
If you click on books, you can see, beginning with the most recent, which was the Carlos Santana book last year, you can see the cover of the book and all of the various awards or, you know, notifications that it got, best book lists or whatever. And you click on the covers of any of those books, they will take you to their own page and tell you much more about the story of that book and that person, like Billie Holiday and the Strange Fruit book or the Coltrane book or the Bob Dylan book. And, you know, yes, they're sold at, you know, I don't know if we need to plug, like, you know, all companies, you know what I'm talking about, you know, but the big one, of course, you know, but also, you know, I always urge people to go to there. If you're still lucky enough to have an indie bookstore, we have one not 10 minutes from us. If you still have an indie bookstore in your neighborhood, support them by going. Not that there's anything wrong with Barnes & Noble and Amazon and Walmart. You know, if that's where you can get your book and that's it, fine. That's great. You know, but if you live in South Dakota or some parts of, I don't know where in England, and there are no bookstores, then that's fine, you know. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff on my website, and if you Google my name, you'll see there are a lot of reviews of my books. In fact, Smile just got 2-starred reviews from Booklist and Publishers Weekly in the United States, which is a pretty big deal. So I'm hoping for more good reviews, and, you know, it's not about money or fame or anything. All I really want is for kids and their parents and caregivers to find out who Charlie Chaplin is, and to go and then go to the library, go to YouTube, go online. You can see these things for free now and just watch one of those wonderful movies like The Circus and laugh and cry.
Yeah, well, I'm biased, of course, but I think it's a very worthwhile endeavor. But just finally, Gary, before I let you go.
Sure.
I mean, it sounds like you have a very talented family as well. So, I mean, if you want to kind of sing the praises of your wife and daughter a little, by all means, feel free.
Sure, absolutely. My wife, her name is Susanna Reich, R-E-I-C-H, and she is an award-winning children's book author. She's done not just picture books and a lot of nonfiction biographies, people like Julia Child, and she did a wonderful book a few years ago on the Beatles as the boys they were before they became the Beatles, which is a fascinating story about their families and who they were. A book on Pete Seeger that came out, I think, 2 years ago, and because Pete, you know, unfortunately, he died. He was a real legend in this country and still is. And she's also written a middle grade novel, and she's just a an amazing writer. She's gotten many awards, and one of her biggest books is called Jose, Born to Dance, which is about the modern American or Mexican-American choreographer and dancer Jose Limon. That's a beautiful book. And my daughter, Laurel, who has my last name, Golio, she is really coming up as she's a freelance photographer. She's been doing a lot of work. She's got a great eye and a great heart, too, but she's a really good artist. Her grandfather would be very proud of her. Unfortunately, he died when she was only four, but he would be very proud to see that she's taken on the Golio tradition of of artistry, and she's doing things for the New York Times and Bloomberg and Newsweek and all sorts of stuff, and her portraits of people are just, they're the kind of things when you look at a photograph and you think, how did that photographer get into that person's soul? So, there's the talent is around, and we're happy to support each other in the family.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much, Gary, for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, Carl, this is really wonderful. This is I'm just starting my promotion, and this is the first interview I've had, and it's been it's been a real joy.
Thank you. Just before we go, I'd just like to quickly thank Raquel Stetcher and Phoebe Cosman from Candlewick Press. Raquel, who suggested that I talk to Gary, and Phoebe, who's helped coordinate this. That's all for today, listeners. So I hope you can join me next time when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.